Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You know, Kherson is such a fascinating place for me because I felt this both when I was there last year and also this week.
Samantha Schmidt is a foreign correspondent for The Post, and she's been reporting from the southern city of Kherson, which was occupied by Russian forces until it was liberated by Ukrainian troops. Then the city was bombed relentlessly by Russian forces and now flooded when a major dam collapsed.
You walk through this city, and first of all, when you're in the city itself, the main kind of center of the city is dry right now, and life is going on normally. Supermarkets and restaurants and cafes where people are sitting on the patio and, you know, just kind of sipping on lattes with their friends. There was a man playing an accordion outside the supermarket. There, you know, seemed to sort of be this mentality that this is just another day in Kherson. But then you get closer to the flooded areas and you just see the level of destruction. And you hear about the bombings that have happened, you know, even as people were trying to flee the evacuated areas. And you realize that, you know, things are not normal in Kherson, but the people here are just so used to being, you know, hit with, you know, catastrophe and devastation time and time and again. And it seems that they are just so good at sort of picking up the pieces and organizing themselves and figuring out, you know, what help do we need? How can we get aid to the people who need it? There was no panic that I could tell.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Rhonda Colvin, your guest host. It's Monday, June 12th. Today we hear the latest from the front lines in Ukraine, where the counteroffensive is finally underway. There are signs of small gains for Ukraine, but still, it's a struggle as Russia strikes back and pursues a scorched-earth strategy. Sam has been reporting from the southern port city of Kherson, which she says embodies Ukraine's struggle and resiliency in this war. Samantha, for months, there was anticipation that Ukraine would launch a counteroffensive against Russian forces.
Turning overseas now, Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia is officially underway this morning.
This is a make-or-break counteroffensive for Ukraine. They've been heavily armed by Western allied countries and the U.S., and there is a lot of pressure on them to perform here. So a lot of excitement also.
That counteroffensive has just now started to get underway. Tell us what this means for this phase of the war.
This is one of the most widely anticipated military offensives in recent history, and it's going to be a huge test for Ukraine to show the world that it is capable of winning back its territory from Russia, and that it can do so with the help of its Western allies, which have spent months helping Ukraine train and arm its troops, which have basically been waiting for this moment, and we now know are officially on the ground and working on making advances in some of the most strategic areas where Russia took territory from Ukraine last year.
And, you know, when it comes to the Ukrainian counteroffensive, we've known this for weeks before it actually happened. Was there a delay? And if so, why?
You know, Ukrainian officials, including President Zelensky, have long said that there wasn't going to be kind of one key moment when they were going to announce the start of this, and that it was going to be, you know, a very kind of, it seemed like it was going to be a slow buildup. We knew it was going to take months for Ukrainian troops to train and arm themselves and prepare for this moment. NATO has been supplying weapons and tanks to Ukraine. And the weather was also important. It was a very wet spring in Ukraine. And in the southern part of the country, it was important to wait until summertime came for some dry weather to really kind of make this big push. So it was a question of training, arming, and just waiting for that right moment for the weather to hit to really get the ground running on this.
So short of driving the Russians out of the territory completely, what are the goals of the offensive?
This is a really important moment for Ukraine to show its allies that the strategy is working, that it needed these weapons from NATO and from the U.S. in particular, that it needed the training, but that it is capable of using all of that to now make this big push. And it, you know, it's important to show that they are winning the war, that they're advancing, that this is actually a war they can claim a victory in. People have been watching from all over to see if this will work, because they know that this is going to be a potentially a months-long process, that you know this is not going to be a lightning-fast offensive like the one we saw in Kharkiv region. This is going to be a difficult one, but what's different about this moment is that they are trained and armed by NATO. And so this is a test to see if, you know, the U.S.-led strategy will work, that basically with U.S. weapons and training, they can fight like a U.S. army on their own.
Samantha, Russia has been waging war on Ukraine for a year and 3 months now. There have been several critical turning points. What's important for people to know about this phase of the war now?
This really is the phase that could be the turning point for Ukraine. It's currently marching towards key cities that, you know, if they win them back, would be huge. We're talking about, you know, potentially Melitopol in the Zaporizhia region. We're talking about Mariupol, which has really been the symbol of Russia's destruction, you know, an estimated 20,000 people killed. It's an incredibly important moment for Ukraine, and it's a different phase of this war, not only because of the territory it's trying to win back, but also because of the weapons and training that it is now armed with. And, you know, this could really be the phase of the war that changes everything for Ukraine. And it is probably going to be a slow and difficult journey, but it's going to be a very closely watched offensive. And it's not just what Ukraine could show its Western allies, but it's also what it could show Putin. This would really add pressure on the Kremlin and would show that, you know, that he potentially miscalculated with this war. And it would deal a very serious blow to Russia and would potentially give Ukraine more support from its allies across the world for, you know, a military victory to this war rather than a negotiated end. And that has been, you know, from the beginning, extremely important to Ukraine. They have said that they will not stop until they win back all of their land. And so this could be their moment to prove that they're capable of that.
After the break, we return to the city of Kherson, where Samantha has been reporting, to talk about life after liberation. We'll be right back.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Samantha, in addition to the fighting, there is another humanitarian disaster: the flooding after the major dam collapse in the city of Kherson. Samantha, you've spent a lot of time in Kherson. Tell us the latest.
Yeah. You know, I was first there last year in November. My colleagues and I arrived shortly after it was liberated by Ukrainian troops.
Tonight, euphoria in Kherson, a major Ukrainian city now free from Russian rule.
Ukrainians hugging. And it was a, you know, incredible historic moment of, you know, kind of jubilant celebrations because the Russians, which had occupied the city for months, were finally out. And it was fascinating because we arrived and we could still see the examples of Russian propaganda all over the city. There was even a billboard there that said, "Russia is here forever." But it very quickly became clear that Russia, despite claiming the city and proudly calling it its own, was not afraid to destroy it little by little. And just days after the city was liberated by Ukraine, shelling started and really has continued for months ever since. We understand that, you know, hundreds of people have been killed or injured by bombings in the city. It's basically become a front line. The city has really been seen as a symbol of resistance for Ukraine. It's a place that, you know, managed to hold on during Russian occupation and has continued to hold on after, you know, months of attacks and of bombings. But it's now a city that is going to be remembered for yet another disaster, this devastating flooding resulting from the destruction of a major dam nearby, which sent water rushing over the riverbanks and into dozens of communities, both in Ukrainian and Russian-controlled parts of the area. Although the water has receded in the last couple of days, there are still large neighborhoods in the area that are underwater. At least 3,000 people have been evacuated. A critical water reservoir, resource for water for the entire region and for the agriculture industry in the region has been cut off. This is really one of the most kind of devastating humanitarian and ecological disasters that we have seen since the start of the war.
Now, Russia and Ukraine blame each other for the dam falling. Do we have any clarity on who's responsible?
This has been a tricky question so far because, you know, it's been tough to get evidence in terms of what exactly happened in the hydroelectric plant and, you know, who did it. We know that, you know, from the beginning, Zelensky and the hydroelectric company, the Ukraine hydroelectric company, said that this was caused by an explosion in the plant in the engine room. And we also know that it was under Russian control at the time. So it seems, though, there's definitely consensus in Ukraine that Russia was responsible. But then, you know, the Russians, of course, are blaming the Ukrainians for it. What we know is that Russia really had quite a bit to gain from this if it was their fault. We know that Ukraine was about to launch a counteroffensive. And so, you know, one theory is that Russia may have attacked this dam in an attempt to help thwart this counteroffensive. But as of now, it's still difficult to say we have, you know, total clarity on what happened and the cause and who's responsible.
You went to a hospital in Kherson and met people who'd been injured by the Russian attacks. Who did you meet?
By the time we got there, many of the injured people had left to other hospitals, but there was one man who was still there who had a story that was just terrifying and I think captures the horror of what Kherson residents are living with right now. His name was Oleh Hryhorak, and he is a 38-year-old security guard who had been staying at a friend's place in a community near the river when a mortar struck the house. And this is my colleague and reporting partner, Serhii Korolchuk, who translated the interview.
So the night of the explosion, Kherson was shelled, and he got under a shelling from mortars.
And shrapnel went flying towards him as he was asleep in the middle of the night, and it ended up lodging into his leg and shattering it. And as he was bleeding and trying to apply pressure to his leg, he had no way to call out for help because his phone had been broken in the blast. And, you know, as he was waiting there for hours, suddenly he started to see water seeping into the house.
And in the morning, the water started flowing in.
And it just so happened that that morning was when the flood water started to rise. And suddenly he realized he needed to get to higher ground or else he could drown. And he ended up hoisting himself onto a couch and sort of waiting there, hoping that he would, you know, stay alive and not either bleed to death or drown. And it wasn't until, you know, that morning that his friends came to the house and found him and, you know, immediately called for help. and he's now recovering. He's got, a metal rod stabilizing his leg, which is all bandaged up. He badly broke his leg, but it seems like he will, recover.
Who were some of the other people you spoke to when you were in Kherson?
Yesterday, we actually accompanied a 40-year-old woman named Katya Lysenko as she returned to her apartment in Kherson on a rubber dinghy. Her apartment has essentially become an island now, and the only way to reach it is either to wade through high water or to take a boat over. And she took it over yesterday to go to her first-floor apartment, which was flooded with thigh-high water, and she was actually going up to her second-floor neighbor where she left two of her cats that she needed to feed. And I'm not sure if you can hear it in the audio, but we actually got on another boat and followed them, and it was actually raining when this all was happening. And she then had to step off the boat and wade through this, murky, smelly brown water, just to get into the entrance of her apartment building and then go up the steps to her own apartment.
How did the flooding change the battlefield?
So we know that the flooding affected military positions on both sides of the river. It seems as though it may have actually affected the Russian positions more. According to Ukrainian officials, the flooding destroyed many Russian military positions on their side of the river, and it caused them to retreat. And we don't know exactly, how many units were there from either side or exactly how their, positions were affected. But military analysts told me they anticipate that this would mean, a sort of reshuffling where, because this front line has been widened essentially by this river that has swelled, it might mean moving troops to other parts of the front line for both sides. So we might see some troops move over to the Zaporizhia region or to other parts of the battlefield, but it's hard to know exactly because, both sides are very coy about the details of, their military, troop changes and battlefield developments. Military analysts say they don't anticipate this will actually change the counteroffensive all that much because, when we talk about the counteroffensive, we're talking about a land advance, in different areas of the front line.
So the counteroffensive has been anticipated for so long. Is there perhaps too much hope pinned to it?
This was certainly a concern, and I know that my colleagues at the Post wrote a story about how Ukrainian officials were concerned that, that there may have been too much hype around this counteroffensive, and it really has been hyped up for months. And that hype is important because it is, Western allies and, particularly the United States watching and waiting to see if this works and if, to see how Ukraine uses the weapons and training that it has provided. But the Ukrainian military is also kind of using that excitement and momentum as part of its sort of campaign around this counteroffensive. We even see it in sort of the public relations around it, where they are really trying to amp up Ukrainians about this next big offensive. So, it's hard to know kind of whether that hype will be beneficial or, have some sort of, negative implications, but it's certainly a moment that, the world has been waiting for.
Samantha Schmidt, thank you.
Thank you so much, Rhonda.
Samantha Schmidt is reporting from Ukraine for The Washington Post. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Gabe O'Connor. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Monica Campbell. Special thanks to David Herzenhorn. If you want to show your support for the show, please subscribe to The Washington Post. It's a great way to support the work we do. Go to washingtonpost.com/subscribe. I'm Rhonda Colvin. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
Hey, parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.